This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own professional website and online shop. Stay tuned to hear details of how to get a 10% discount and a free domain name.
Coming up today, Google and Facebook ditch the tasteless Bomb Gaza app, plus how to reconstruct speech from a silent video of a packet of crisps, and a deceptively simple TV aerial has won the Hack North Korea Challenge. Plus, are you switched on when you should be switched off? In this always-on world of ours, should we not be taking lessons from the offline world? We'll be discussing that in our discussion portion. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from the on to the off. I'm your host, Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Liak Clark.
Woo, it's the power team. It's the dream team.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I've had dreams about this team in the past, actually.
I've definitely
I think it's quite literally a dream team.
Yeah.
Do you know what else I had dreams about recently?
Please tell.
I mean, I can't tell you most of them because, you know, HR and blah, blah, blah. But being at number one in the iTunes tech podcast charts right now. And guess where we're sitting right now? We are the podcast cherry on the giant cake that is all other podcasts in the tech section.
Wait, your dreams have come true.
Yeah. I mean, it's happened before. I just happened to notice that it happened just before we came into the studio. So thanks, everybody, for making us number one. Take that, BBC Click. I gave them fair warning that I was coming for them, so they knew this was going to happen at some point.
Step it up.
Honestly.
They must be quaking in their boots.
Yes. Well, we'll see. But first, the news.
Unless you've been living on the moon, you'll know that the Middle East crisis has been escalating over the last few weeks, and obviously missiles have been exchanged between Hamas and the Israeli Defense Forces. But as it happens, I think there's actually a ceasefire talk taking place today in Cairo. But that hasn't stopped an opportunistic game developer from creating this incredibly distasteful app called Bomb Gaza. And this is an app that simulates Israeli attacks on Gaza. And the game invites users to drop bombs and avoid killing civilians, which is charming. And it was briefly published on Google Play before being pulled from the store after lots of people noticed it and started posting outrageous reviews.
I can't even imagine the impetus behind developing this game.
I can. I think the
attention.
Guy... Yeah,
well,
exactly.
But this goes beyond attention.
Stupidity. I mean,
grabbing.
There was an interview, a quote that came out of the developer's mouth, who said he'd done it in 2 hours and it was not with any planning or thought, and people are just haters and they're hating. And
oh, come on.
His quote-unquote defense was as transparent as cling film.
But I mean, it actually hurts me in my heart and my stomach to read the words of this story. Like, how can anyone think this is an attention-grabbing move that would ever hold them in good stead in the future?
Yeah, I mean, they have, I guess, it's a tiny little game development company. They've made two games previously that have both been pretty rubbish. They've got crap reviews for reasons other than being massively offensive. They've just not been very good games. So this is the most attention they've ever got. Invariably negative attention. And clearly it violates the policies of Google Play Store. It's, you know, Google Play bans any apps that depict gratuitous violence or endorse kind of hate speech, you know, advocating against groups of people based on their religion, ethnic origin or race.
Well, I have a comment to make here that I do not want to be interpreted as what I often do, which is play devil's advocate to provoke debate. However, I am curious about two facts behind this story, or two aspects of the story. The first is, would we be up in arms over this if the timing was very different, i.e. if this incredibly awful situation going on was not going on at the moment? And the second observation is, there are a lot of games out there, particularly on consoles and PCs, that do depict effectively burly, muscly white guys basically bombing terrorists, Russia, China, and it's the same old trite drivel nonsense storylines about, you know, the West defeating the communists and defeating Russia and defeating, you know, people who don't speak English, basically.
Yeah, that's
and
exactly
a lot of these games, a lot of these games just follow that sort of routine.
They and do, but this is based on real events.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they tend to be generic, kind of stereotype-based sort of conflicts. Although we did recently discuss the Panamanian, former Panamanian dictator.
Yeah, he's suing.
Who's suing Activision for his portrayal within a game.
You see, I don't know if that's really a case that's going to stand, because it's not really like, I mean, in a libel case, it's not like he's got a reputation to defend,
exactly.
Because it's basically been damaged by crimes and going to prison.
Yeah.
But it does make me wonder, and, you know, I think this app is incredibly offensive and insensitive and is rightly removed from this store completely. But it does, if you factor in the wider gaming community, there are a lot of games and titles out there that, while not so politically sensitive as this one, do basically depict a lot of similar themes in war zones.
Yeah, maybe they are making some kind of clever commentary on the gaming industry.
No, there's nothing clever behind this at all.
No, but I mean, most of games will fall into two camps, which is they'll either be like historical warfare, they've done the World War II and all sorts, or, and even the Panamanian one is kind of relatively in the past, or really generic tropes of the West against X, Y, and Z, and you know, that just, well, this highlights how stupid it is that nobody complains about teaching millions of teenagers across the globe that the West should destroy communism, or whatever it is.
I think another aspect to this is that the fact that the quote-unquote game was so incredibly bad as well. You know, it wasn't like it was a well-considered political commentary that was perhaps deemed offensive but had some sort of underlying message.
No.
It was basically ridiculous.
Yeah, and I checked out the Facebook page, and the guy has just posted absolutely no remorse. There's loads of criticism on the Facebook page for the Play FTW, Play for the Win company. And they just simply posted, at least we're getting some attention.
No. I mean, it's embarrassing. The whole thing's embarrassing.
They say any press is good press, but that isn't necessarily always true. Because do you really want to... Are you really going to put this on the press release? From the people that brought you Bomb Gaza comes ridicule murder victims.
It's totally inexcusable. There isn't really any kind of justification for this act of stupidity.
I agree. I do wonder, though, in future, whether topics such as this and by extension, other very politically sensitive world affairs will become the subject of tomorrow's video games, in the way that, you know, the most recent Wolfenstein game was all set around what if the Nazis won the war. And sometimes I feel, okay, well, it's just meant to be a bit mindless and stupid. But at the same time, it's like, shall we drag out the Nazis again? And this time we're going to make them supervillains, even more so in a fictitious sense, that is.
Yeah.
And we're going to give them robots, and we're going to have the evil Nazi doctor doing torture experiments on people. And it's like, really? Do we need another one of these? But I just wonder if this is going to happen again. Are we going to have games in the future that basically use something like 9/11 or the London bombings as subject matter in 30 or 40 years, when perhaps it's not considered quite as sensitive by the next generation of gamers and developers as it would be if that sort of thing was released today?
I think you'd be... I mean, there are games on the other side of things where people get to play terrorists. You know, and I think that the instances that you just cited are obviously incredibly sensitive topics that
at the moment.
But I can't imagine ever like 9/11 being the key scene.
It sort of was. There was a game, Call of Duty Black Ops, I think it was. No, Modern Warfare 1 or 2, where there was a scene that you had to pretend to be as undercover a Russian terrorist and basically open fire on innocent, terrified civilians in an airport. And this was released, you know, within the last, I think, 6 years. I think it was 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. And it was hugely controversial, of course, and sparked a storm. And a lot of people said it's just in there for press and what have you. And some people defended it and say, well, it's just fiction. And people then say, well, it's fiction, but it's at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And that's basically saying, we can't talk about this. We can't joke about this now, guys, too soon.
But then what about movies?
I mean, what
was there was the movie about that flight that crashed at the same time as the 9/11, the Twin Towers incident.
It wasn't at the same time, was it? After, they've done several films about it.
Flight 249, whatever.
Yeah, they've done a couple of those films.
But why is it okay to explore it in films, those sorts of incidents?
No,
perhaps not.
I don't think there is a problem with exploring it. It's just like, off the back of talking about this is you playing the aggressor and kind of making light of the fact that a country is bombing civilians.
Yeah.
Relatively. Or it's using the massacre of huge numbers of people and the destruction of life as a topic for telling a story.
I don't think that in itself is a reason why you can't tell a story, but I don't think it's been done in a sensitive way.
Yeah, exactly. It's the way you do it. Those films were tracking the story of what happened. This game is just saying, let's just bomb the crap out of some people, but hopefully not civilians.
Well, let us know what you think, regardless of whether you think this game is good or not. podcast@wired.co.uk is where you can and should send your opinions, should some have just formed in your mind. Meanwhile, in Crisps, it's now possible to reconstruct speech from a silent video of a crisp packet. Out of context, in fact, actually, even in context, this sounds madness, Liat.
I know, I almost don't believe it.
No, it's like a string of madness drawn from the brain of a madman. However, it exists because we've written about it.
Yeah, or MIT is just making stuff up.
Some mad myth.
Yeah. So a team from MIT says they've done this with Microsoft and Adobe engineers in tow with them. They've actually managed to recreate these sounds using a complex algorithm that is tracking tiny movements of a vibrating crisp packet, which is in the same room as somebody giving a speech. These vibrations are obviously so minuscule, you would never notice them, but, you know, they have got a handy algorithm for that.
So let's just visualise this for people having struggling to possibly understand this. This, somebody filmed a packet of crisps in a room in which somebody was talking.
Exactly.
And then the video was stripped of its audio, and the movement, the tiny movements of the crisp packet in the video was used to reverse engineer a recording of the speech in the room the crisps were
in. But it was even in soundproof glass, so it wasn't even like they had to strip the audio. There no audio in the first place on the video. To have this work effectively, they had to use some pretty
high-speed cameras, I imagine.
That's exactly what they had to use.
How
but
fast?
Between 2,000 and 6,000 frames per second.
That's pretty fast.
That's pretty damn fast.
Yeah.
It did work if they did it on just an ordinary digital camera of 60 frames per second, but you would never get the whole speech back. They got things like how many people were talking, what genders the people were that were talking. But with the very, high-speed video frequency, they could capture the entire speech.
Does this actually mean that we could, if we fitted CCTV with, 6,000 frames a second cameras, that we could hear criminals talking in, a crime scene?
That is what, in my head, I am picturing for the future, having read this story.
I'm scared of the future, Liz.
I think so. But the thing is, they obviously have a ridiculous amount of work left to do. They've done this with water vibrations, aluminium foil, and plant leaves. But the point is that every object will respond differently to sound. So it depends what is in the room with those criminals and whether MIT has nailed whether, a vibrating spoon can reconstruct sound from it.
This isn't that weird, because we've written in the past about putting lasers onto a plastic cup in a room and then picking up on the vibrations from that cup to listen to what's going on in the room. And then we also, I remember discussing something where it was about putting lasers round a corner, so you didn't have to go round into a room, you could just shoot a laser into a room, and it would, the way the light would bounce back could be picked up, so you could see behind walls, essentially. It was a kind of defense.
Okay,
system.
Liv, but vibrating crisp packet.
15 years ago, I remember watching this VHS documentary about people who thought they could hear ghosts. They said that although this particular house was not haunted, which obviously, as we all know, is entirely possible and not the result of quantum fluctuations, they could press their ear against a wall and hear the bricks playing back piano songs that were played in that building
in the park
when it used to be a pub. And they said, we can hear these bricks playing music. And
That's the investigation.
Yeah. they did a whole documentary trying to work out whether this was possible.
The sounds of the past.
But just imagine if you could film that and you could reverse engineer the vibrations of old piano in the brick.
Whoa. So we can finally prove whether No, we can't. Leah,
don't take this too seriously.
No, well, I was just thinking there must be some like neighbour like with a kind of adjacent wall who was there tinkling
just
the ivories.
Just bangs out their keyboard every...
And then hides it when the ghost police come around.
Yeah, with their inspection
probes.
Yes. Well, if you think that you have heard walls playing music to you, don't email podcast@wired.co.uk. But if you do have an opinion on whether the future of CCTV should be analysing data in such a way, podcast@wired.co.uk welcomes your comments. It's time to jet off to North Korea, virtually, though. I'm not allowed in North Korea, so we have to do this from a distance. A three-person Korean-American team, which includes two 17-year-old college students, won a weekend-long hackathon sponsored by the Human Rights Foundation, designed to help people in North Korea, which regular listeners may remember us discussing in a previous episode a couple of weeks ago. The team's idea, which actually hasn't yet moved beyond the concept phase, is pretty simple. Import a bunch of satellite receivers into North Korea so that people can simply receive TV stations from SkyLife, which is a major South Korean broadcaster. Right now, SkyLife's satellite footprint does actually extend into North Korea, and it includes a lot of Korean language stations like KBS and SBS, which are two of the largest broadcasters in that area. But it does also apparently include some English language programming, including The Beeb, Eurosport, and for good measure, I love this, Animal Planet, amongst others. So under this plan, the team claims North Koreans could start to learn more about how their South Korean cousins live via news and sports, entertainment, and I suppose animal action too.
I don't want to be a downer on this.
Go on though.
If it was as simple as importing satellite receivers, I feel like we're missing something.
Yeah, it's not that easy to do. There are people that make homemade radio kits that get sold on the black market in North Korea, and they do look like the very first Apple One computer that Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs built out of like wood in a garage. It looks like that with no discernible features on the top, just a little knob for tuning radio stations and no visual identifier. And they listen to them in like bunkers after hours and
stuff. Surely that would be better than somehow sneakily get the message on how to make them rather than we'll just ship some in.
Radio is a little bit easier to decode than a satellite broadcast signal.
Yeah. Okay.
Unfortunately, because they're digital.
But basically, they're not going to be able to import these.
They've won the competition because they're going to get a round trip ticket to Seoul, the capital of South Korea, paid for by the HRF. And while they're there, they're going to meet North Korean defector groups and other organizations that the HRF says, the HRF is also going to help secure funding to get this project off the ground. So I guess that's a problem that they've identified, and they have at least got some ideas of a solution.
But they were completely flat was one of the key things, wasn't it? They were flat in design, the receivers, so they could almost be
posted, but they were very easy to disguise and put
into a document wallet or something like that, as opposed to being bulky and cumbersome.
Oh. Yeah, and I guess chances are the guards over there are not going to say, "Oh, I've seen one of those before. That's a flat satellite receiver."
Yeah,
it's going to probably be disguised to look like something innocuous.
Well, I imagine they do look through all the mail.
Or maybe they'll be dropped by the air balloon. Otherwise,
this wouldn't be a problem.
Well, we'll have to keep our eye on how that particular challenge is overcome. But we will, of course, keep you posted on all things related to infiltrating North Korea. Do you know what that was?
No.
It was the theme from Ghostbusters.
I really don't think it was.
It really wasn't.
What did I do?
I mean, both of you feel slightly off, but that's much better.
Yeah, I'm not very good at singing.
All right, Egon. Well, actually, you could become tomorrow's Egon Liv, because apparently a Ghostbusters reboot is going to happen that may feature an all-female team. And I, for one, hope that Dawn French gets to play Slimer. Just coat her in green-dyed KY jelly and suspend her from the air with invisible wires.
I mean, they should do that anyway, but perhaps, you know, just for lols.
Yeah, Dawn French. Yeah. I don't think that's her calling.
I love her so much.
Yeah. I adore Dawn French completely.
But we're digressing anyway.
We are a bit. Sorry about that.
This year is the 30th anniversary of Ghostbusters L'Original, and there have been rumours about a comeback for many years, particularly after the Ghostbusters 3 attempt failed repeatedly to get off the ground. So the last film was made in 1989, and shortly afterwards there was lots of talk about having the third film set in a demonic version of Manhattan called Manhattan.
Oh, I see what they did there. Yeah.
And there were even talks of introducing a new generation of Ghostbusters back then. sadly, the all-important Bill Murray could not be persuaded to reprise the role of Peter Venkman. And then the original director stepped away after Harold Ramis, who played Egon Spengler, died this year. So Sony has jumped into the scene and it's decided to turn it on its head and wants to reboot the film with a female cast.
I'm terrified, by the way, that this is going to be Charlie's Angels with proton packs.
That would be awful, I think. But the director is Paul Feig, who you might remember as the teacher from Sabrina the Teenage Witch. But more importantly, he's also directed Bridesmaid and The Heat. But then also you've got to get Dan Aykroyd back in. I mean, he's knocking around at the moment promoting the 30th anniversary. So I'm sure he could come in as the kind of mysterious teacher.
He'll be the Charlie.
Teacher, yeah.
He could be Slimer.
He could be Slimer.
Cover that man in jelly.
And quick. Give him a hug.
And yeah.
Give him a slippy hug.
Do we have any kind of date for this, or is this just an idea?
It's still a bit of rumour mongering, but we will definitely keep you updated as and when we know more.
Who would you cast as Slimer? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. The last news story for today before we move into our ever-popular discussion segment and the feedback loop is that Gmail is auto-scanned for child abuse images, and as a result, a man in Texas was found to be in possession of illegal images. And, well, Liat, why don't you pick up from here?
Yeah, Google has actually been kind of working in this area for some time. They've been working with the Internet Watch Foundation for years to help take down websites featuring child abuse content. And in the early days, this would be if they got reports of it. I mean, that still goes on, obviously. There's numbers and emails you can contact people to have these taken down. But it's also developed these digital fingerprint technologies so that it can track, basically auto-scan the interwebs. And as it turns out, Gmail. It turns out it's been doing the exact same thing, and that was how this discovery was made. So Google just obviously passed the details on to the police straight away, who got a warrant to search the man's devices, and the incriminating content was found. It's actually allowed to do this with Gmail after tweaking its privacy policy earlier in the year, which basically stated that all your content, including emails, attachments, sent, received, stored, is up for scanning grabs. So you might be in two minds about giving away all your data to Google, but on the other hand, they are at least doing something of a good with their powers.
Is this the tip of the iceberg? How long until we're scanning email for BitTorrent files?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is
pirated software.
This is quite this is one area where you kind of can't say anything against it.
No, there's not much debate about whether or not it's a good thing to remove child
abuse
images.
But as Nate says, obviously governments they already compel them to give up information for this, that, and the other. And as things become, as they tighten constraints on other things, it can expand.
My question wasn't going to be whether this is a good thing. I think it is. My question is more along the lines of if Google is in charge of having to do this, how long until it is under pressure to do it for other illegal content? Because they have powerful lobbying groups in the US who will push things like the DMCA into law. And I do wonder whether this could extend into other areas of illegal material.
No, well, I mean, potentially anything could happen. But in this case, Google isn't necessarily obligated to do this. They want to do it, and they have always, obviously there's pressure on them to do it, but they've got, they do this to, scan content to apparently improve your user experience. They're already scanning all this content, and it's something they've been doing for years, and it's always been a voluntary thing. So it's not like they're being forced to do it, and then they can say, well, if we're going to do that, maybe we should, we should be able to do this.
Let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk and we'll BRB.
This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own professional website and online shop. The easy-to-use drag-and-drop tools, responsive designs, and 24/7 customer support teams based in New York and Dublin mean you can create a beautifully designed website for as little as £5 a month. This includes a free domain name when you sign up for a year. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code WIRED to get 10% off and to show your support for Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team. No credit card is required to give the service a spin. Visit squarespace.com to support the show.
Welcome back. It's the discussion portion of today's podcast pie, and this slice is brought to you by the segment title Made in the UK. Well, we are welcoming a new voice, although a familiar voice, into the podcast cave this week, and it comes from the face of Katie Collins.
Hello.
There's that voice. Now, we wanted to bring Katie in because she wrote a story that prompted a mini debate over our desks in the Wider Cuddy Kate office this week. And her story was about the New Forest National Park launching an initiative that encourages people to hand in their tech at the gate and embrace nature hands-free. Although I suppose it's more with their hands free of devices. Mm. So they can touch trees and fondle the earth like Mother Nature of days gone by. Is that not true, Katie?
That is true. That's exactly what they did. So the tech crush was kind of instigated in order to help people escape the modern world.
Oh, yeah, we didn't mention what it's called. It's called the tech crush.
Yes, the New Forest tech crush.
We've replaced babies with phones, but yes, the principle is the same.
Yes. The idea is you hang on to your babies, mm-hmm, and you also get them to hand in any tech that they might have. And by doing that, you're supposed to appreciate the outdoors more.
I see. It's an interesting idea.
It is.
How can you appreciate it if you're not Instagramming it? How will anyone know you're appreciating it?
Well, that is the reason this is our discussion topic for today, because we wanted to talk about whether in our always-on world, we should be taking lessons from the off. We need more off in our on is basically the moral of this debate. Mm. And I wanted to talk about some experiences of how obsessed we are with checking devices. You know, are you a sitting on the toilet retweet checker like my brother? Or are you someone who prefers to leave their devices at home while they go out for a meal so they can enjoy that burger email free?
So I'm glued to my tech. I'm glued to my phone the vast majority of the time. But there is something a little bit sad for me that we have to sort of create these, that we have to have this place in the New Forest to force us to part with our devices.
But that's for people like you.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly, for people like
you're
you.
You're a stare downer. You need to be staring more forwards.
Yeah.
And fair, I do the same thing. Do you know what? I don't think the New Forest is the place to have a testbed for this because it's got terrible signal.
Yeah.
I tried to Instagram a picture like 7 times there the other day.
Let's not sail too far away from the fact that this is a bit of a PR stunt, but it is worth talking about because it does represent a very real trend, which is, you know, if you can't go and look at a squirrel without looking at your email, you know, then what's wrong with the world?
There's this major trend, though, towards this idea of a digital detox. And there are lots of camps and hotels and who are kind of promoting themselves as offering these sorts of services. But likewise, as we've discussed in previous podcasts, there are also technologies that are emerging to help us kind of, you know, cleanse ourselves in some way, either to prevent us from browsing too many distracting websites or having things like, as we've discussed many times, stuff like Headspace app that helps us to kind of unwind in this very busy, always on world.
But it's more things to remember to do. I think downloading apps to help you not use apps is almost self-perpetuating nonsense. Mm. And I do like Headspace and I like Budify as well for these sorts of things, but they are sort of clearing your head from distractions around you so you can stress while reading email stress.
Yeah.
And but I've recently put this to the test and I ditched Facebook and Twitter and email, well, not all email, but as much as I could at least, for like 3 months, and I would turn off notifications, so no notifications would pop up on my screen. I know that I've got loads of email. I don't need reminding every 30 seconds that another one has arrived. It just adds stress. Mm. The fact is, you're going to check your email anyway, so why be bothered being notified about it? Mm. It's incredibly therapeutic once you get used to it. And the simplest way to do it is just stop doing it, and, you know.
But it's also all our apps are built to not let us stop doing it. Like WhatsApp drives me mad because I'm always dismissing, and my texts and everything, I'm always dismissing notifications.
Of course.
But they keep coming back until you click on them and actually read it. So I feel like we've got our work cut out for us. So in that respect, it's okay to download an app that combats that?
Well, the Facebook Messenger stuff recently has really annoyed me because, firstly, Facebook made me download Messenger because it inexplicably decided that the Facebook app shouldn't let you send messages to friends. And I downloaded it, and I immediately, as I've done with all of my apps, turned off notifications. And every time I load that app, it says, turn notifications on, turn them on. I have to dismiss that every single time. If you dismiss it enough, it then overlays the screen with a big black screen that says, this is how you turn notifications off.
Nate, I have a pop-up on my phone every single day saying, sync Facebook with all your apps in order to streamline whatever. I don't know. There's like an automated Facebook message. Does everyone else get this? And no. I've dismissed it like 1,000 times. I do not want to sync Facebook with all of my apps. Thank
no,
you.
Don't do that. Nice. And this is why I'm not a big fan of the oncoming smartwatch trend, because I don't believe that I need my wrist to vibrate in addition to my groinal area every time I get a new email. You know, I can know that vibro free, not a problem.
I think it's really interesting that we've all picked up on Facebook as being a kind of central.
It's a big target.
Yeah, it is. And personally, I've found that Facebook is really distracting in that I just kind of automatically go to it all the time as well. Mm. And when there's nothing, that even when there aren't notifications or there isn't anything there, and actually I kind of I'm scrolling through and I don't, you know, I sort of wonder, what am I doing here? Is there any point in this? And I know a lot of people who've sort of quit Facebook recently have just said, you know, enough. But I've decided what I'm going to do instead is have 1 week a month where I don't look at Facebook or any other social media outside of work hours, just so that I can have that, just to remind myself that actually I don't want or necessarily need to have this all the time.
Well, I would like to make a suggestion to anyone who is intrigued by this concept. Force yourself, if you're married or got friends or going out for dinner or something like this, leave your phone at home and go out for dinner. Just do it once, because it is a very odd experience, but it's actually very nice once you get used to it. It does actually make just something as simple as a dinner out a very different feeling experience, because suddenly, you know, you're not doing the checking when someone else goes to the bathroom. It's pull out the phone. You know, yeah. You might not do anything, but you might start noticing other stuff. And it makes me think of something else that I think we should end up starting to see. And I think this is floor-based advertising. Because nowadays, back in my day, I'm really sounding like quite a convincing old grouch, aren't I, at the moment, for someone who runs a technology website and what have you. But I'm just saying, balance, people, balance. A heavy metal album is not heavy by the end if there are no quieter tracks in between. It is about peaks and troughs. But what was my point? Oh, yeah. Putting adverts on pavements so that when everyone's walking around looking down at their phone, their eye might be caught by floor-based advertisements instead of the ones on the walls and on billboards being ignored in favour of mobile devices. So I think that's going to start happening soon.
That's a terrible idea. Yeah. So then not only are you looking at your phone, you're also looking at more media.
I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm just saying that I think it will probably happen.
Okay.
Advertisers will start buying pavement space.
But it's actually quite interesting, because it's well known that lots of big Silicon Valley execs actually allocate a couple of hours in the morning where they don't open their email, they don't look at any media, they set aside thinking time. And I think it's something that came up in at the Wired Money event as well, that we just, no one ever sets aside time where you're not distracted by media just to think. And I think that's very important.
I've started doing that now. When I go for my, when I take an hour for lunch, I never used to take a lunch hour. I always take an hour now because we've got a park opposite and it's very nice in the hot weather. And I've turned email off on my phone. So I get no distractions whatsoever when I'm in that park. It's fab.
Mm. But are you listening to podcasts?
Yep. But I'm not getting notified about press releases.
No. Good.
You know, or you asking me endless lists of things that I might want to address.
I'm such a girl bag.
I know, it's so bad.
I like to do it when I run. That's my quiet time. Mm.
I've been experiencing it because I keep breaching my data limits on my mobile phone contract.
That's a great way to...
So I can only check when I'm in the office. When I walk into a store, I've already pre-programmed the Wi-Fi, or when I'm home. Well, so at first I'm really twitchy, and sometimes I turn it on and I'm like, I'll just turn it on for 5 seconds. 5 seconds, get my email update.
Well, the purpose of this discussion, apart from to highlight the fact that we all are basically obsessed with checking our devices all the time, which is not new information, but it is an opportunity to experiment with turning, not just turning them off or not pulling them out of the phone, actually don't even bring them with you. Leave them at home and get the person you're with or people you're with to also leave their devices at home just for like one evening and just see what difference it makes to how the things that you do. What do you do instead when your friend goes for a wee and you've suddenly got nothing to do? What do you look at? What do you notice? Things like that. It is genuinely, I think, having put this into practice and now regularly do it, it feels as, not nice, that's a really simple word, but it feels as pleasant and convenient and enjoyable as it first was when I got an iPhone and I could suddenly read websites on a sort of a larger screen. It sort of feels equal and opposite to that.
And hopefully it will reintroduce punctuality, because one of the great things I remember from pre-mobile phone era was that you always got somewhere on time. Otherwise, you were in deep doo-doo because you never knew where your friend was. Yeah. And having no phone means that you are compelled to arrive at the place you say you're going to be at the time that you said you were going
to
be there.
I had this the other day when I went to Secret Cinema, and they say you're not supposed to bring phones with you, and obviously everybody does. And I was like, For a minute, I just freaked out. I was like, how on earth am I going to meet my friend? And there are all these people standing there saying, I told my friend I'd be on the corner wearing the checked shirt. And there's like 3,500 people wearing 50% wearing checked shirts.
Also, I would encourage people to kind of, I mean, like this kind of campaign basically says that you should do, just put things down and also look at stuff more without looking at it through a screen, even when you're taking photographs and stuff. I remember when I was in Indonesia and I went on this amazing orangutan trek and my friend's camera broke, and what we did was we used my camera and we took it in turns, and actually we thought it was going to be really inconvenient, and you know, she was really sad that her camera had broken, but in the end it turned out to be the best thing that could possibly have happened, because instead of watching these amazing creatures through like on a tiny little screen while I was taking photos of them the whole time, I was actually enjoying being there with them and like looking at them and that kind of thing. And that is the kind of, you know, those are the experiences that we might be missing out on a little bit these days, I think.
I think so, and I've put it into practice recently, and I think that it definitely works. And it's not about becoming a hermit or, you know, being a technophobe and suddenly hating everything or turning vegetarian and giving up all meat. But it does change the way that you interact with the world in a way that is actually really quite beneficial. Definitely. So I'd encourage people to give it a go and try those sorts of things, or try turning off notifications of your email or something, and see, does it actually make any difference to your productivity that you aren't being notified on each email, but in actual fact are just checking it because you know email is going to be there? Or try going out for dinner and leaving your phones at home and seeing what difference that makes to your evening. And then, crucially, let us know how it goes. podcast@wired.co.uk. We would love to hear your feedback. Was it awful? Did something terrible happen that you blame us for? Or did you actually think, you know what? I spent all my life living in a peak. It was nice to have dinner in a trough. That was completely unplanned, that sentence at the end.
That was great.
I apologise.
But now I'm imagining piggies eating out of a trough.
Now I'm thinking of bacon. Let's stop thinking of bacon. Let's jump into the feedback loop. Right, we have two pieces of feedback this week. We've got one from Igor, we've got one from Jules. We're going to start with Jules, aren't we, Liat?
Yeah, Jules says, so, guys, now that you've settled into your role so comfortably, I'd like to know your thoughts on the killer app or much-needed product for porn, Liat, for Ladybits, Liv, and for your now-to-be-revealed predilections, Katie and Nate.
Interesting.
So, Jules,
this is all sounding a bit personal.
Yeah, well, she, you know, she's identified a few niches in our reporting style. For porn, I'm gonna go with an app that, if you're a male, so there's loads of holes in this, okay?
Well done.
There's loads of holes in this business idea because I just came up with it. But I was writing a lot about age verification technologies and the various controls. So how about you have an app where, if you're a male, it only lets you view porn if you can answer correctly questions about the female anatomy or how to pleasure said female?
That's interesting. So then you have to have had, you know, perhaps instead of using porn as your only point of reference for sexual experience, you have to have educate yourself about intercourse before you
exactly a more mature understanding of what it means to be a female and a male coming together.
Interesting. Liv, I'm going to have to say this sentence. Much needed product for lady bits.
Yes.
We've written about quite a few that already exist that probably don't need to exist.
Yeah. Some, I think some do need to exist. I think this is just a sort of upgrade on a product we've already spoken about, which was the Kegel muscle exerciser. No, Kegel exercise tool, which... You have to insert this device inside the lady, and then you have to clench and use the clenching of your lady bits to control a player on the screen of your mobile. And I think the thing lacking in this device and app combo is a competitive element where you could compete against your colleagues and friends and people across the world. So the Wired.co.uk lady team was keen to get a number of these devices to compete on our lady bit clenching power, and I think that would be entertaining.
Yeah, I want a tournament next week if anyone would like to give us a Kegel. I don't think you should lend them.
That's going to be one of the most awkward things I will ever have to edit in my career. I might offload that responsibility onto Katie. Okay, well, mine, I've been having a think about mine, and I'm actually going to change my idea based on the previous discussion topic in the podcast, which is I would like an app that uses my current GPS location to show me the best relaxing places around me, but not only that, but maybe it could plan my time for me as well, using knowledge about how far it would take me to walk to said area, what activity is available there. Maybe it's something you have to book and they can check and see if they have availability, maybe two or three places, and it can track the distance between these activities. So rather than having to sit there stressing about where to go to not stress out, you can press a button and it says relax me or something, which I suppose in a way would work for Liat's suggested app too. And it just gives you a little guide. It says walk here, go there, and then it'll alert you and say it's time to leave, and it guides you to the next place perhaps, and the booking is all there and the reservation is there, or whatever you need is there, or whatever you might need to pick up on the way can be navigated as well, and it will take the stress out of managing stress perhaps.
That's basically going to be the Siri of the future.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that's great. Well, walkit.com should start looking into that. They do, you know, routes that you can walk, quiet routes, polluted routes.
I'm going to call it Unclenchify.
Wowzer. Yep. Coming off of Ladybit Clenchify.
Oh, yes. God. Oh, we're so linked, aren't we? We're so linked. God, you can't tell that this isn't scripted, can you, at all? This is, you would think it was, but it really isn't. We have one more here, email from Igor that we want to get to, who I think's written in before about this same topic.
Yeah, he said, great to hear your voice again, Nate. As you're probably aware, I've been listening to the Wired podcast when you're away, and the ladies have not been putting in the outtakes at the end of the shows. Could you please sort this out? It's a key part of it. I'm sure many listeners would agree.
This is when I dump a little outtake at the end of the podcast, isn't it?
I'm sure we stopped doing this before.
I thought you stopped doing it before.
Usually when it's not been there, it's because I forgot or because we didn't record any outtakes, because we pretty much record this in one take.
Don't think we communicated that fact, and I'm not sure. No. I've been listening to the outtakes anymore because...
they're embarrassing.
Mm. Well, because we have to listen to right to the end of the credits.
Yes, I know, it's a little gift for the people that stay to the end. Well, maybe we'll pop one in there today. Who knows? We'll have to listen past the music to find out. You can send us your thoughts on apps, perhaps, or devices that should exist that don't, to podcast@wired.co.uk, along with any thoughts and feedback about any of the topics that we've discussed or haven't discussed. podcast@wired.co.uk. We will see you in 1 week.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine. Yeah, I couldn't get in at that angle.